US, which is not their own.
Professor, I think we have come to a good conclusion, which is the Austrian model is the best model for all of Europe.
I would agree.
That would be the best model. So, Professor, we have about 5 minutes left. If you could please, then let's look into the future. We already began talking about in terms of conceptually what could happen, but let's make it a little bit more practical. So you're saying right now the situation is very polarized. It's very hard to begin these conversations in Europe, even though the majority of the people in Europe feel that this is not in their interests. Of course, we have also the winter coming up, and this issue of gas and the issue of energy prices. We see in Italy there's already riots. People burning their energy bills in front of the city hall and threatening a boycott of paying their energy bills. We see in Germany a very strange thing happening. People going back to idea of using coal for fuel and going to the forest and cutting down the trees for the firewood. I'm simply saying these things because these are things that are actually happening. I don't want to exaggerate the issue, but it seems to me that this winter is going to be a very interesting winter in Europe, because, as you said, the effects are going to be felt maybe in ways that still are not being felt, even though they are being felt. So if you could maybe give us some insight, give us your analysis and your views about this idea of having an alternative vision, a vision that's different than this Cold War and this idea of not having relations with Russia. If you could give us a little bit more practical, what you would suggest practically we should be doing maybe in the next 5, 6, 10 years for this to happen?
Yeah, I have to say, of course, it will be a difficult winter for Europe. It will be not that dramatic as some observers would see it. Of course, the reserves for gas and oil, 85%, they are full. But the problem is the price, because
exactly.
The Europeans are buying oil from or gas from the U.S., from Norway, Netherlands, the democratic country of Azerbaijan, and
Algeria.
So I don't want to be cynical now, but that's,
yes, exactly.
it will be expensive, and the prices will be a problem, and we'll have recovered after the pandemic. Now they will fall back in terms of unemployment. Some factories companies will close. So it will be very difficult. And the Europeans seem to be united in the sanctions against Russia. But if it comes to the energy discussion, of course there are pledges that we are still united. Well, they're not that united, the Europeans. Mm-hmm. They have different interests, and you see it now if you look at the debate on the price cap on Russian gas. So Austria, for example, and others would say, no, that's not feasible. Other European countries
right.
would want to do it. So in practical reasons, there might be come out very different things, and the European Union might blame members and other members which are not going along. It might be Hungary and Poland. Maybe it will change in Italy with a new right-wing government as well. Some member states will blame the Commission, and there will be always the excuse, we have to do it on a European level. So we have to have speak with one voice. That's not going to happen all the time. So because in foreign policy, of course...
Right. So, Professor, that's very interesting you mentioned this, because this brings me to maybe the gist of the whole, this the key to understanding a lot of things. We had this European integration process, and I remember you once mentioned the idea of these expectations not really meeting the reality. And in some ways, we maybe have... because we like to talk theoretically, both of us, in terms of our academic background, that maybe we have now come to the understanding that there is such a thing as national interests beyond what this idea of European common interest, that maybe there is going to be some sort of a, maybe not formally, but informally, a split within the European Union.
We are back to another international relations theory. We have this functional relations, that's integration theory.
Exactly.
And the European idea was based on this. So that means you have cooperation on the lower level, science, technology, economy, spill over to political and security, and then common defense and common government. It worked to a certain level.
Exactly.
So it worked. But it does not go
all the way.
Common defense is no question right now. Common defense policy, yes. cooperation, right. Strategic compass, or everything, whatever. But it doesn't go to, Europe doesn't want a common commander, so who decides whether soldiers are going to die.
Exactly.
So and not the common guy. And here the Europeans have to be realistic and say, exactly. We have to can go to a certain level. And there can be multilateralism on this level, and the European Union can be active. And my favorite example is the JCPOA.
Right.
The JCPOA was after 2015 a masterpiece of multilateralism. But the idea is you have certain member states that can do something, and the European Union would support it. So you need not have the common consensus of all the states.
Right.
Otherwise, it's always an excuse. Right. So you can do this on a lower level, and some countries can do it. So the JCPOA would be a good example. We will see how it plays out. Right. But for the European Union, it's possible that the European Union can do something on a level beneath the common government, beneath the common voice.
I guess my question is this, Professor. Is it really, are these those Western European nations and elites who are pretty much fully invested in NATO and in the alliance with America, are they capable of accepting that a country like Hungary, like Poland, like Germany, might have its own national interest vis-a-vis Russia as opposed to theirs? Maybe you could say, okay, Belgium, what does Belgium have to do with Russia? Okay, we can say that. But there are countries that really their national interest is not to be at war with Russia. I mean, is this something that, because this goes back to the idea of ideology, is the ideology so deep, this Atlanticism, this idea of that, you know, America is the way to go for Europe, particularly after World War II and the horrors of Nazism, the crimes that happened with communism and Stalinism that happened in Eastern Europe. Is Europe capable of having this diversity of interests and handling it?
Of course, the transatlantic bonds are very strong. Of course, right. We have NATO, but Europeans always think the Americans helped out in the First World War, Second World War, were the leading state during the Cold War against the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union. They closed their eyes during the Vietnam War. They closed their eyes already when we had the coup against Mossadegh. They closed their eyes.
They usually close their eyes when the Americans...
In Chile.
Exactly.
But there have been differences already during the Iraq War. You saw Germany and France. They were not really happy with the decision, and there was no UN Security Council authorization. So we should not discard the transatlantic bonds.
Right.
But what I do think, of course, European states might find out they have their own interests as well, especially when it comes to the use of force, use of violence. After all, the European Union considered itself as a peace union from the start.
The whole point was that there would be no war.
Right.
Exactly.
So I should go back. It will be a process, but it might be possible.
Professor Gärtner, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you so much for our wonderful discussion that we had. I think we might have to do another one at some point, maybe the next season.
Back to Tehran soon.
And next time you're in Tehran, inshallah, we can have another discussion. Mm. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for the conversation.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Professor Gärtner? The US and NATO have once again successfully divided Europe and created a new Cold War against Russia by disregarding legitimate Russian strategic interests for decades and using any opportunity to provoke and humiliate Russia. Behavior which was criticized after the Cold War by none other than the father of Soviet containment policy, the late George Kennan, and which today is being criticized by none other than the still living Henry Kissinger. After NATO's humiliating defeat in its 20-year campaign in Afghanistan, this new Cold War and NATO expansion is a lifeline for the military-industrial complex in the United States, which requires permanent global war to justify its evil existence on this earth. Brainwashed Atlanticist European elites proudly reject the wishes of their own populations to proclaim their fidelity to NATO and their allegiance to the US, disregarding the real on-the-ground consequences of these policies for the daily lives of their own citizens. An unprecedented level of Russiaphobia and blatant in-your-face propaganda is sweeping the West, creating a suffocating atmosphere that gaslights and browbeats anybody who might dare to suggest that it is in Europe's real interest to have good relations with its massive neighbor, the Russian Federation, independent of what the US thinks of this. Once again, we come to understand that geopolitically, Europe is an American colony, physically and mentally occupied by one of the victors of World War II nearly 80 years ago. The Western rejection and isolation of Russia has been very good for Eurasian integration. The old nightmare of the British imperialists and their US inheritors, such as the late Zbigniew Brzezinski, creating a history-changing strategic alliance between the great Asian powers of Russia, China, and Iran in the global heartland. Of course, the old Anglo-American strategy is to separate Europe from Asia, to keep its European colony firmly in its own grip, and to divert Europe's wealth and resources towards its own military-industrial complex, depriving Europeans of the benefits of joining a new era in human history, the era of a strong and wealthy Eurasia. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we briefly discussed Imam Khomeini's return from Paris to Iran a few days after the Shah's escape from the country. Today, we are going to relate the story of his arrival in Iran. After 14 years of exile, Imam Khomeini arrived in Iran on February 2, 1979. The companions of Imam were very concerned and restless as they thought of the possibility of terrorist attempts or bombing plots against the Imam during the trip. Although the last prime minister of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, had agreed with the landing of the Air France flight in Tehran, there were rumors among people of a conspiracy to assassinate the Imam. Some said that the airplane would explode in the air. Others spoke of the likelihood of changing the course of the airplane and abducting the Imam. However, people in the country were looking at the sky, waiting for Imam Khomeini's flight to appear. The streets leading to Mehrabad Airport were full of millions of lovers who had gathered enthusiastically to welcome their beloved leader. Hundreds of stands were set up to distribute sweets and candies among people. Yet, the only face which was unchanged and serene was the face of Imam Khomeini, as he was sitting in the airplane in complete calm. He was so calm that when a reporter asked him of his feeling in those moments, he only answered, "Nothing." This was so amazing that the reporter didn't ask any other question. Nevertheless, the Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, was very worried and preoccupied with the thought of Imam's healthy flight to Iran. She would think if the regime would let him free or would arrest and imprison him. Would the Imam's security be guaranteed during the flight? Would he be secure at the airport and his transfer from the airport to the place of his speech? Would his life be guaranteed among the swarming population in Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery? Where would be his place of residence? These and scores of other thoughts had occupied the mind of the Imam's wife. When the news of Imam Khomeini's health reached his wife in Paris, she sighed in relief and thanked God for this great bounty. After his arrival in Iran and residing at Alavi School, Imam Khomeini asked Ayatollah Mutahhari to make the preparations for his wife's return to the country. Thus, 2 days later, the lady left Paris for Tehran. In the first days, the Imam's wife was residing at a different place due to the big number of people who came to visit the Imam. At first, women were not allowed to visit the Imam. But soon, Imam Khomeini asked those in charge to determine certain days for women's visit. Therefore, the Imam and his wife could meet one another in special intervals. In view of this, many ladies, as soon as getting informed of Ms. Saghafi's residence, eagerly rushed to visit her. Imam Khomeini's daughter, Zahra Mustafavi, says in this regard, "When my mother resided in this house and the locals and other women were informed of her presence, rushed to meet her. My mother would sit on a bench and the visitors would come in a long queue to greet and meet her. Some of them, who were closer relatives or old friends of the lady, would sit in the room for formal reception and some of them would stay for lunch or dinner. My mother's warm welcome and smile was very memorable for all who met her. Dear listeners, on February 9th, just 3 days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, a group of the Air Force officers came to Imam Khomeini's residence as a sign of their allegiance to him. Indeed, it was as a parade before the Imam. This parade was registered by Hossein Partovi, the skilled photographer, who took the photo from the back of the officers, not to be recognized by the agents of the regime. The photo of the Air Force officers was published on Kayhan newspaper. This once more revived the hope of victory in the hearts of the people, while the puppet premier of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, was scared and panicked. When the newspaper was taken to the Imam's wife, she mentioned two important points. Firstly, the Prime Minister would no longer rely on the Air Force, and secondly, the photo was both artistic and epic. She even tried to estimate the number of the officers from the photo. The next day, a group of the Shah Special Guards attacked the Air Force officers to avenge their parade. The news of this move soon was spread everywhere, and people confronted the guards till the next morning. When the Imam's wife heard the people's support for the Air Force officers, she prayed so that all events would end in victory. Thank God, the Islamic Revolution triumphed and the enemies were frustrated.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
We gather at a vital time for the United Kingdom. These are stormy days.
The UK Prime Minister Liz Truss may not have known what she walked into when she took over the premiership just months ago from the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. An economy battered by COVID-19, then the Ukraine conflict, which impacted the UK's economy negatively. With runaway inflation and a cost of living crisis, she had to come up with a plan. That plan was presented by the finance minister, or exchequer at the time, Kwasi Kwarteng. But she could never have anticipated the firestorm and crisis that erupted afterwards. After several U-turns of whether or not she would go through with what was called a mini-budget plan, she was forced to finally make amendments to the plan. And what many have called a move to save herself and her job, she fired the now former finance minister, Kwasi Kwarteng.
I met the former chancellor earlier today. I was incredibly sorry to lose him.
She replaced him with Jeremy Hunt, a former health secretary and foreign secretary, who was announced as Kwarteng's successor.
It was a mistake to cut the top rate of tax at a period when we were asking everyone to make sacrifices. And it was a mistake to fly blind and not to back up the economic plans that were announced with an independent forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility.
Truss scrapped the pledge to reverse predecessor Boris Johnson's hike of corporation tax from 19% to 25%, a decision estimated to restore around £18 billion, or $20.1 billion, to the UK Treasury's coffers by 2026. Her explanation for scrapping the plan: markets were not ready for it.
But it is clear that parts of our mini-budget went further and faster than markets were expecting. So the way we are delivering our mission right now has to change.
The Institute of Fiscal Studies had doubts on the so-called mini-budget, basically calling into question where the money was going to come from. It said that unfunded tax cuts meant that the UK will need £60 billion in spending cuts. It also said that this would leave ministers making serious reductions in public services. This puts into question the claims made by the former Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng.
The government has been clear that protecting consumers is our primary focus and shapes our entire approach to this issue.
As for the 2.5% targeted growth, nonsense. Said the UK will struggle to grow at more than 0.8% on average over the next 5 years. In other words, the £45 billion cost of the mini-budget would wipe out any financial space left to the Chancellor by his predecessor, swelling Britain's debt as the share of national income for at least the next 5 years. The turmoil that exists in the UK mirrors what is happening across many European countries. Economies are under strain and people are suffering as a result. Wrong fiscal policies can be the reason for this suffering, but political directives also impact people's lives and well-being. That couldn't be more evident on the EU, led by the US, to continue the war on Russia, even if it meant that their own citizens would suffer as a result. But cracks are emerging following the U.S. lead. For example, France has joined Germany in accusing the U.S. of using Ukraine war to overcharge for gas. After the Ukraine conflict, the EU was forced to start importing LNG from the U.S. as well as other countries. But the U.S.'s share had increased sharply from 28 to 45%. On the other hand, deliveries from Russia dropped by 75%. But this statement from the French economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, shows that France may have caught on to the U.S. role in the Ukraine conflict. Le Maire recently told French MPs that the conflict in Ukraine must not result in the U.S. economic domination and a weakened Europe. This is while the economy minister, Robert Habeck from Germany, accused LNG exporters, including the U.S., of charging too much for gas, at the time when Europe's biggest economy is struggling to balance its energy mix without Russian supplies, and when German companies are closing down factories due to high gas costs. Electricity cuts in the UK and emergency gas rationing in Germany are just a couple of signs of how European leaders are sacrificing their country in order to defeat Russia and the less threat that they face from it. As for their economies, Europe has already slipped into a recession, and there are no signs that it can devise a plan that would lower energy costs to pre-Ukraine conflict levels in order to save their economies.
Whether signed in the White House or overseen by a U.S. president or secretary of state, the United States has almost always had a role in any and all negotiations between Palestinian and Israeli sides. Looking at some of the more important instances of these talks, one can think of the first Oslo Accord in 1993 that was signed in Washington in the presence of then-U.S. President Bill Clinton. The 1999 Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum that was signed in Egypt was also overseen by the U.S. through Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State of the Clinton administration. The unsuccessful Camp David summits in the year 2000 was overseen directly by Bill Clinton himself. Following the unsuccessful peace talks, Clinton would make another effort at influencing the Israeli-Palestinian relations through the aptly named Clinton Parameters, showing the extent of his and U.S. involvement in the talks. Sometimes this influence even meant that the fate of Palestine would be discussed without the participation of any Palestinian representative, as was the case in the Camp David Agreement in 1978, which was signed by Egyptian President, Israeli Prime Minister, and then U.S. President Jimmy Carter, without even an Arabic version of the documents. These showed the never-wavering U.S. Pledge of Allegiance to Israel, a pledge that will always protect Israeli interests, which would automatically go against Palestinian interests. Among the most important of these interests is a trinity of inalienable rights defined by the Palestine National Council in 1974, which consists of Palestinians' rights to self-determination, an independent state, and most importantly, right of return. The most recent example of neglecting these rights occurred in 2020. During Trump's tenure, the deal of the century was presented, which many later called the flop of the century. The Trump peace plan was titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. But it was far from that. The plan had been delayed by 2 years and previously rejected by the Palestinians, who were not invited to the meeting. The plan never materialized, however, since, again, it was not representative of the Palestinians' rights on major core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The first time Israel attempted to make the smallest bit of compromise was at the Camp David summit in 2000. Israel said it would be willing to allow 100,000 Palestinian refugees back to their homeland, while the millions of others had to be resettled wherever they were at the time. Also, Yasser Arafat, then chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, would have to forego the idea of right of return completely from then on. Similar ludicrous proposals that were rejected by Arafat were all proposed, with the U.S. being on board with these proposals. The U.S. involvement in the so-called peace talks have time and again shown Palestinians and their officials that the U.S. is not to be trusted as a neutral party. On the sidelines of the sixth summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia in Kazakhstan, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In it, he expressed that he is happy with Russia's position on Palestine. He also said that he would only accept U.S. involvement in the conflict resolution process if other parties of the Quartet on the Middle East were present. The Middle East Quartet, established in Madrid in 2002, is a foursome of nations and international and supranational entities involved in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. Its members are the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and Russia. Palestine's hand is now one of unity, since the Palestinian factions have all established peace amongst themselves, including Hamas and Fatah. Palestinian factions signed reconciliation agreements in Algeria. Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year after the successful talks held in Algiers. Meanwhile, when it comes to peace talks between Israel and Palestine, Abbas has stressed that Washington should not be given free hand to act alone in resolving the decades-long Palestine-Israeli conflict.
The rising rivalries between the U.S. and China are set to dominate the coming years in the 21st century. That is because the U.S. has unveiled this long-delayed national security strategy, where China is named as the most consequential geopolitical challenge for the regime in Washington. That means that Washington is prioritizing winning over China, as Beijing is seen as the only global rival to the U.S. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "The People's Republic of China harbors the intention and increasingly the capacity to reshape the international order in favor of one that tilts the global playing field to its benefit." The U.S. strategy further insists that China represents the most consequential challenge to the global order. It also says the U.S. must win the economic arms race with the superpower if it hopes to retain its global influence. The strategy has warned that China's rapid advances in technology is aimed at molding the world order. The strategy is in line with the rhetoric pursued by the Biden administration and its predecessor. Biden officials have accused Russia and China of looking to change the so-called rules-based order. The term has come to be seen as a synonym for Washington-led world order. The Biden administration has entangled itself in a number of global crises, including the war in Ukraine. The Washington regime encouraged the war in Ukraine by sending more weapons into the conflict zone. Washington is using the crisis to contain Russia. And by encouraging its allies to sever their energy ties with Moscow, Washington is trying to push European countries into its own sphere of influence. Furthermore, Washington is stoking tensions in the East Asia region by strengthening its ties with the Chinese Taipei. Back in August 2022, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, drawing an angry reaction from China. Beijing has warned that it will not tolerate Washington's meddlesome interference in its own affairs. But Washington's increasingly belligerent behavior in Europe and East Asia has pushed Russia and China closer together. They have forged closer ties in a variety of fields, including energy, business, and defense areas. Furthermore, both Moscow and Beijing are key members of the BRICS groups of countries and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Two bodies are playing key roles in shifting the Western-led balance toward a multipolar world. Russia and China have also forged closer ties with countries like Iran and India, which are emerging powers in the shifting geostrategic relations worldwide. It is now widely believed that Washington's ambitions to still lead the world is facing tough challenges. It appears that the regime in Washington has no longer the capability that it once possessed to dictate its hegemony.
Iran hosting the 36th International Conference on Islamic Unity in the capital, Tehran, which hosts 200 Shia and Sunni clerics, as well as thinkers from some 60 different countries. The annual event puts into discussion the challenges faced by the Muslim world. It's widely believed that uniting Muslims in the region and worldwide would be a great step in alleviating the problems they're facing. Violence and wars are killing Muslims in Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, proposed the idea in the 1980s to bring Muslims together against the imperialist aggressions and interventions of Western powers. Over the years, Iran has championed the cause of Islamic unity and brotherhood. This is when many other Muslim countries have brazenly become facilitators and enablers of America's neo-imperialism. The highlight of this year's event was a speech by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to the participants of the conference. During his speech, President Raisi hailed resistance as the only viable path to confronting the Israeli regime. Raisi further said that history has proven wrong those countries who assumed that negotiations would save Palestine.
The biggest human rights violators are the US, Israel, and some Western countries, despite their claims to be human rights defenders. See their record, what they have done to their own people and the people around the globe.
Raisi also referred to previous deals reached with the Tel Aviv regime on the issue of Palestine, saying the regime has refused to honor the commitments it has made. He also criticized the Arab governments that normalized their ties with Israel and the Zionist regime. He said the U.S. and the Israeli regime are trying to marginalize Palestinians through normalization deals. Raisi was referring to the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan and Morocco, which normalized their ties with Israel in late 2020 under deals pushed by former U.S. President Donald Trump. One of the issues that was highlighted in this conference was how Muslims in Palestine are brutally oppressed by the Israeli regime, which is supported by the West and some regional Arab states that have betrayed the cause of Palestine. The normalization deals with the Israeli regime has emboldened Tel Aviv to carry out more war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories.
It's no surprise to us that the House of Saud has teamed up with the Israeli regime. They claim to be Muslims, but in fact they are the puppets of the Israelis and do what Tel Aviv dictates to them.
So far this year, more than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds amid a massive increase in Israeli military raids. Israel has killed five times as many Palestinians in 2022 than it killed in the same period in 2021. And on the issue of Palestinian prisoners, nearly 300 rights groups have condemned the continued detention of Palestinians in Israeli prisons. They called on the international community to act against the crimes of Israel. The groups also censured Israel for its administrative detention of Palestinians. Conferences like the one held in Iran helped the Palestinian cause by continuing to point to the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. If the Palestinian cause is not the most important issue for Muslims and the wider world, then Israeli forces will continue using excessive force in their dealings with the Palestinians without being held accountable.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Clearly, those who maintain the prayer are not the same as those who pray. There is something else there too. There is some higher reality. What do you think this could be? What does it mean to maintain prayer? There are several possibilities, any one of which could be correct. One is that maintaining the prayer means performing prayer perfectly or completely, as this is one of the meanings for the verb iqama, to maintain, in Arabic. In other words, it means to do something completely or fully, as in, so set your countenance, فَأَقِمْ وَجْهَكَ on the religion as a people of pure faith. Surah 30, verse 30. In other words, turn your countenance in its entirety, your being in its entirety, towards the religion, completely and utterly. This is one meaning. And it makes sense in this context. If someone maintains the prayer in this way, this means to perform it fully and completely, on the correct basis, paying attention to the teachings and inspirations of prayer. If someone offers prayer in this manner, then success and salvation are really expected for them.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When someone prays properly, all problems become easy for them. Have you not heard of those people of great faith who whenever they face any difficulty or hardship, offer two rak'ah of prayer? Have you heard that when the Prophet faced trials and tribulations, he would turn to his companion, Bilal, and say, Grant us relief, O Bilal, or cool us, O Bilal. By this he meant that Bilal should recite the call to prayer. If someone truly maintains their prayers with attentiveness, with humility, with awe of Allah, with presence of mind, and with an understanding of the significance of what they are saying and doing, intending to get something out of their prayer, if someone who prays like this and maintains their prayer in this sense, then he will definitely receive those things which have been promised to the faithful. This was one possibility. Another possibility is that those who maintain the prayer means that they pray in a community, that they make a community that prays. Some people feel happy when they pray alone. Instead of 17 rak'ah a day, they offer 51 rak'at a day, not to mention other recommended prayers. Someone tells them, people are leaving the religion in droves. This does not concern them. As Sa'adi says, they pull their own rug back from the wave.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
The Limelight.
The Zionist regime, in a blatant and barbaric move, has authorized its military to kill Palestinians with drones in the West Bank. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Throughout website roads, commanders of the Israeli Occupation Forces, IOF, have been authorized to use armed drones to kill Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, with the approval of Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Aviv Kohavi. Hamas called the order a dangerous step and urged Palestinians to continue resisting the Israeli occupation with all means possible until they regain their legitimate rights. The authorization to expand the use of killer drones coincides with a significant rise in shooting attacks and massive gunfire during arrest raids, specifically in the northern West Bank cities of Jenin and Nablus, according to the Jerusalem Post. On September 28, the IOF killed 4 Palestinians and injured dozens more during protests in Jenin. Since as early as 2008, the Zionist regime Air Force has been killing Palestinians in Gaza with drones. They have also been used to fire gas bombs and live rounds in occupied Al-Quds. Although drones have been employed for surveillance, this is the first time armed drones will be utilized in the occupied West Bank. Drones comprise 80% of the total flight hours in the Zionist regime air force. But the Zionist regime has no right of self-defense against the people whose land it occupies. The Fourth Geneva Convention says that an occupying power has a legal duty to protect the occupied. As an occupying power, the fabricated regime of Israel cannot use military force against the occupied Palestinian people. Under international law, the Palestinians have a lawful right to resist the Zionist regime's occupation of their lands, including through armed struggle. In 1982, the UN General Assembly reaffirmed the legitimacy of the struggle of peoples for independence, territorial integrity, national unity, and liberation from colonial and former and foreign domination and foreign occupation by all available means, including armed struggle. In May, Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aqile, known as the Voice of Palestine, was reporting on an illegal IOF mass arrest raid on the Jenin refugee camp when she was assassinated by an Israeli regime sniper. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, ICC, classifies the targeting of war correspondents or journalists reporting from war zones or occupied territories by killing or physical assault as a war crime. Although the Zionist regime initially denied that an Israeli regime sniper shot Abu Aqile, it later said there was a high possibility that she was accidentally hit by IDF forces' gunfire. On September 20, Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq and London-based research group Forensic Architecture issued a report finding that the Zionist regime forces repeatedly and deliberately targeted Abu Aqile with a well-aimed bullet. Her vest that said press was clearly visible to the IOF shooter, as shown by the detailed digital reconstruction from Al Jazeera footage. The same day that Al-Haq and Forensic Architecture released their report, the International Federation of Journalists, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, and the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate filed a complaint in the ICC on behalf of Abu Aqile family and journalist Aliya Samoudi, who was also shot by IOF forces at the same time as Abu Aqile. Al-Haq is one of the six Palestinian human rights groups that the Zionist regime baselessly designated terrorist organizations and one of the seven raided by the IOF in August. The Zionist regime's assassination of Abu Aqile occurred just days after a coalition of Palestinian journalist organizations and leading human rights lawyers filed an initial complaint in the ICC protesting the systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists. Jennifer Robinson, a lawyer for Abu Aqile family, said the killing of journalists is an attempt to cover up and prevent their work in documenting human rights abuse and fosters impunity for the injustices that they are seeking to cover. The Zionist regime's High Court of Justice effectively legalizes almost every act committed by the Zionist regime's security forces. Ishai Menochin, executive director of the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, wrote in the book Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues, "One can only conclude that Israel's HCJ is one of the primary enablers of the ongoing Israeli occupation of the occupied Palestinian territories. Another enabler of the Zionist regime's illegal occupation is the U.S. government, which provides the Zionist regime with $3.8 billion annually in military assistance. The Biden administration has refused to condemn the Zionist regime for its illegal terrorist designations and raids on the Palestinian human rights groups or its unlawful assassination of Abu Aghla. U.S. President Joe Biden has twice refused to meet with Abu Aghla's family face-to-face. Those who speak out against the Zionist regime's illegal occupation face serious consequences. Progressive journalist Katie Halper was censored and fired by The Hill for defending Representative Rashida Tlaib's description of the Zionist regime as an apartheid regime. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem have all characterized the system in the Zionist regime as apartheid. The Hill is owned by Nexstar Media Group, which calls itself America's largest local television and media company. Journalists who report the truth about the Zionist regime's crimes incur the risk of being fired or even assassinated. Neither the Zionist regime nor the U.S. government and its corporate media will tolerate any criticism of the illegal Israeli occupation.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The four Geneva Conventions, especially the Third Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful, as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive, the lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners' issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoners' swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abu Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a